Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, I'm happy to have back Oxford medievalist Caroline Larrington. We will be covering Catelyn's ascent to the Eyrie and talk about that complicated relationship between the Tully sisters. Steve and I will be covering the first of his name. So this episode is heavy on the Eyrie and Lysa and Sweet Robin. You're going to love to hear more about him. In keeping with that theme, I included a snippet of my conversation with psychologist Gregory Webster. We talk a little bit more about Sweet Robin, and Greg reminds me of a detail in the books that suggests that our young friend actually has psychic ability. Maybe there's a psychic thread in the Tully line. You are not going to want to miss that. Without further ado, here is medievalist Caroline Larrington. Caroline Larrington, welcome back to Electric Boogaloo. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever done a walk in the Lake District?
I have to say I never have, actually.
I have. I didn't know that by walk, my host meant hike. And he asked me if I would like to go for a walk in the Lake District.
That's a very British distinction. Going for a walk can be anything from a stroll around the city centre to what you would definitely call a hike.
And what would have made sense to me is, would you like to go for a walk up some very steep hills? I mean, I'm not a big hiker. I'm not a big fan of walking uphill. I do like lakes. I like beautiful scenery. It was gorgeous. But boy, oh boy, did I not know what I was getting in for that day.
And that's kind of like the landscape of the Vale in some ways.
Yes, I was feeling a little bit like Marillion that day. You know, he kind of thought, this sounds adventurous. This will be something good I can talk about or sing about later. But he absolutely had no idea what he was getting in for. And then, you know, he acquits himself okay by the end. He survives. I was kind of thinking, yeah, I'm a little bit like that. I'm not the heroic type.
Well, it is quite terrifying when I was rereading it last night, that little bit where even Kat says, "Ooh, I can't do this. I just can't go over that saddle with the drop on either side."
Yeah.
And Mia has to lead her across. I was thinking, no, even with my eyes shut, you would not get me over that.
Okay, I'm going to read a synopsis of this chapter, and then we can talk about it. As Catelyn climbs to the Bloody Gate, she is met by Sir Donal, Knight of the Vale, who will escort her party to the next stronghold. Cat recalls three encounters with the Mountain Clans, and how several of her men had been lost. Soon she is greeted by her uncle, Brendan the Blackfish, who escorts her through the valley into the foot of a mountain named the Giant's Lance. The Blackfish hears Catelyn's story and warns her that Lysa has changed, and not for the better. He explains that the pressure of King's Landing, the death of her husband, and the fear of the Lannisters has driven her younger sister to panic and extreme caution. Cat's final hike up to the Eyrie is guided by Mia Stone, a so-called bastard girl of the Vale. This is done along steep steps with mules and in the dark. When Cat finally arrives in Lysa's Solar, the two sisters argue about how to best deal with the Lannisters. Young Robert Arryn suggests that they will make Tyrion fly. Caroline, would you like to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I just climb the Ladder of Chaos?
I think we should just climb the Ladder of Chaos, because I'm sure all the rest will come up as we talk.
Chaos it is. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was struck thinking about the chapter this morning as to what a great example it is of Martin's world building. That we've suddenly come into this completely new space as Kat gets to the point where she can see down into the Vale.
Yeah.
And it's really beautifully described with the waterfall of Alyssa's tears, and then the Giant's Lance, as you say, the mountain that the Eyrie is built on. And particularly interesting, I think, is the way you can't quite catch sight of the Eyrie. It's so high up. And you just occasionally see the light glancing off it. And you think, whoa, that is high. And that is mysterious. What is she going to find when she gets up there? And you have these kind of alarm bells sounding, first of all, quite gradually, when The Knight of the Vale, who greets her, says that Lisa is very strict about who is stationed where and who is allowed through and so on. Mm-hmm. And then the Blackfish is much more forthcoming. But even so, he doesn't really want to frighten Kat too much. So he kind of minces his words slightly about what she's going to find when she's reunited with her sister.
Yeah, so the geography and her sort of state of mind are in some way parallel. And just showing her extreme caution, and even so much so that she is wary of Kat. You know, she acts like she is glad to see Kat, but immediately she's angry that she's almost angry that anyone would dare to come, because she is so isolated and she feels like that is her one strength, you know.
That's right. It's a wonderful switch, isn't it? From the kind of, oh, how lovely to see you, dear sister. Yeah. Yes, dear sister, and so on. And the minute everybody has left the room, she's kind of shrieking at Kat, why are you here? And why have you brought Tyrion with you? And you can see that terror which is driving her. And in some ways, I think at this stage, we know that Lysa is right, that the Lannisters are to be feared. And even if the Lannisters don't know where Tyrion has got to at the moment, because they've been put off the scent, I guess, and are expecting to find him on the King's Road going up to Winterfell, nevertheless, Lysa is kind of right that this is not a good situation for her to be in.
Mm-hmm. I'll read this just the short part. Oh, Kat, how good it is to see you. My sweet sister, she ran across the chamber and wrapped her sister in her arms. How long has it been? Lysa murmured against her. Oh, how very, very long. And then I'm going to skip down here. She seemed to notice the others in the room, her maid, Maester Coleman, Sir Vardis. Leave us, she told them. I wish to speak to my sister alone. She held Catelyn's hand just as they withdrew, and then dropped it in the instant the door closed. Catelyn saw her face change. It was as if the sun had gone behind a cloud. Have you taken leave of your senses? Mm-hmm. So you really get that sense that Lysa is so, I don't know if paranoid is the right word here, but I wrote down paranoid a couple times in my notes and I thought, well, maybe I'm reading too much into this character. But she's so cautious that there are deceitful or, you know, prying eyes in the room, that she will even sort of put on this show, even isolated up near the sky, in her own bedchambers, she is going to put on this little show just for a few people in the room, because she doesn't want to reveal anything about her true feelings, you know, with anyone watching. Even when she's isolated, even when she's totally protected in the stronghold, she is playing the Game of Thrones, and you really feel like that those 5 years in King's Landing really hammered home to her how dangerous the Game of Thrones is.
I think that's absolutely right. But at the same time, and you can see from Kat's point of view, it's kind of, what does Lysa expect, having sent that letter to Kat in the first instance, the letter that, you know, kicked off so much of the whole plot line?
Yeah.
Events in Winterfell and King's Landing so far about the death of Jon Arryn and the suspicions that Lysa has, and all the trouble that then comes in Winterfell with the attack on Bran and so on. You kind of imagine, well, you know, Lysa, what did you think, you could just send that letter and nothing would happen? Lysa says, well, you know, I just wanted to warn you, that's all. But right. Kat is a doer, isn't she? She's not somebody who just looks at the letter and goes, mm-hmm. And because she shares everything with Ned, of course, she has set things in motion that Lysa, I think, hadn't quite expected.
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I'm not sure what to think about Lysa's motives here, because she certainly says, I sent you the letter so that you would stay away from the Lannisters. But it almost makes me think, like, does she not know her sister? Wouldn't she know that Kat would sort of be a more proactive? And because we know that there's a bit of intrigue here with Lysa and Littlefinger, I wonder if the letter was meant to manipulate, even if it was in her voice. I wonder if Littlefinger is sort of behind that, because it's just hard for me to think that Lysa would expect anything less from Kat. But that's an unanswerable question at this point.
It's unanswerable at this stage, isn't it? I think, because we haven't seen so much of Littlefinger.
Yeah.
And Kat is still thinking kind of fondly of him from the old days. And she talked about Littlefinger in her previous chapter and saying, well, I'm sure he didn't go around saying that he took my virginity.
Right.
And Tyrion and the others are going, well, he certainly did. And so we're beginning to get a sense of doubt about Littlefinger, which Kat is a bit slow in catching up on. But you can see the seeds of doubt beginning to be sown there previously. It's entirely right that Littlefinger has more or less made Lysa write the letter without Lysa really knowing at all what Littlefinger is up to.
So, yeah, we see Littlefinger, like, we in retrospect, right? It would be hard to see this on first read, but I think that in retrospect, we really see that Littlefinger is leveraging his relationship with these two sisters to, I don't know, sow some chaos seeds, I suppose.
Yeah.
And in a way that will probably put a wedge in between these two sisters. And he's going to try to use it to his benefit at some point. I don't know if he knows exactly what's going to happen, but I do think...
He'd have a pretty kind of prophetic sense to know exactly what would happen. I think he's just like somebody kind of poking a stick into an anthill just to see what happens when the ants run out.
Yeah.
And thinking, I can capitalize on whatever happens.
That's right. And I do think he thinks, okay, well, if I leverage Kat's trust for me, then I'm really also manipulating Ned and the North. So I'm not sure exactly what Littlefinger thinks will happen, but whatever the case, he is absolutely behind this growing divide between these two sisters.
Yeah. And it's going to turn out that he's always been kind of playing them off against each other.
Yeah.
Hasn't he? I mean, whatever his feelings originally for Kat back when they're all young.
Mm-hmm. And then I also, you mentioned Kat's doubt, and there's a great line in this chapter where for a moment she's looking at Tyrion, and Tyrion just looks like he's totally unworried about his predicament. And she wonders, it's just one line, she wonders if she's maybe misjudged the man. And maybe he is innocent. Maybe he isn't behind all of these horrible things that I'm accusing him of. And then immediately she kind of puts that away. You know, she puts that to the back of her mind and she thinks, no, I'm going to, it says she resolved to go forward. And it's almost as if she's thinking, too many men have died because of this decision. I'm going to go forward as if this was the right decision.
Yeah. And you can see that when the Blackfish turns up and they're talking about what's happened, you can see that he's, with his political sense, not only of what the situation is in the Vale, but more generally, that he thinks that whatever it is that Kat believes about Tyrion probably isn't correct.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a bit more doubtful. And there's a point where Kat is having to justify herself to him, and she has to answer uneasily. And you can see that kind of growing sense of maybe, just maybe. But you're absolutely right. She's kind of committed herself now. It's like getting on that path in the darkness to go up to the Eyrie, that there's no turning back. And I think that terrifying journey up the steps is kind of like Kat's path at this point, that every step forward just limits the possibilities of going, you know what, I was wrong, let's start over.
Interesting. It's such an interesting way to show us just how difficult it would be to actually bring armed forces into this area. And how a lot of these medieval strongholds would use geography to their advantage for that very purpose.
Yeah, you can exactly imagine the kind of castle. Just thinking of I guess some of the examples you see in Germany. But even some of the Welsh castles you look at and you think, yeah, that would be really, really hard to take. Even if you don't build a moat around it, which of course is one way of making attack difficult, but just being so high up and with a single route up there and such a problematic route as well. You can see why Lisa says, well, they will never take the Eyrie. The castle is impregnable. And Kat, in a way that I think is going to foreshadow later events, says, yeah, no castle is impregnable.
Right. I don't know if you have off the top of your head the name of a few castles in Germany that our listeners could maybe do a Google image search for. I've never seen a castle that was this protected by the geography. I've seen castles built along cliffs where, like, if you were going to go to it, you really have to choose this one route up. And then, of course, it would
No, I
be.
can't quite think of a German castle. I'm just thinking of some ruins along the banks of the Rhine. But I guess somewhere like Tintagel, which is not so high, but it's on an island.
That's exactly the kind of thing I was thinking of.
And you can't climb up those cliffs to get there very easily. And I guess somewhere like Harlech as well is now got a town built around it, of course, but it's high and you can see everybody coming from where you are.
What Martin does is by bringing Kat step by step along this journey, he really does show how impregnable this thing would be.
Yeah, and I really think it makes you think about the way in which castles function and how they're defended. It's part of that kind of exactness and detail that Martin so likes to bring to bear on the world that he's creating, that it's not just a question of the castle's really high up a mountain, it's hard to get to. You really do have to think about not just about how you might attack it, but how did they get provisions up there. And then he tells us about the baskets and how practical it is actually to live somewhere like that, and how isolating and what kind of effect being hidden up there must be having on Lisa, sorry, even if she hadn't brought her own kind of paranoid fears with her from King's Landing. It's a really unhealthy place to be.
That's interesting. So I think that there may be a couple other little literary hints in this chapter. Early on, she's thinking about the men that have been lost because of her decision. And she wonders if her heart is turning to stone because she doesn't quite, she's not quite lamenting the loss of these men. And there's just that little hint, like, early seeds of Lady Stoneheart here. That's
I
interesting.
didn't spot that. Yeah, that's very good.
Sometimes she felt as though her heart had turned
I
to
turned to
stone.
stone.
Six brave men had died to bring her this far. Anyway, there was that. And then, of course, she meets along the way someone named Mia Stone.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that she has these complicated feelings about this person she's never met before, just because of her status as a bastard in the Vale.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, she kind of warms to her at first, and then there's that moment where she freezes and thinks, a bastard, another bastard, and thinks about Jon Snow up there at the wall and turns, if she's still kind of being polite and smiling, but so there's a kind of chill in what she's thinking. And then Maya confides that she has a lover who's a squire and is hoping to become a knight, and then they'll get married next year. And Kat is thinking, oh, that's not going to happen. No
No.
knight marries a bastard.
That's of course never going to happen. She knows these class distinctions really mean a lot to Kat. When Mia says, some people like to do this with their eyes closed. Kat says, "I was born a Tully, and I've been a Stark for these many years. I don't scare easily." Those names mean everything to her.
And that's kind of reinforced too, isn't it, by the fact she's just seen the Blackfish, and so who even he is is wary of going up that path by night.
Yes.
Mules or no mules. He thinks that Lysa is mad to send for Kat at that point. But yeah, you can see that Kat absolutely bridles at the suggestion she might have to shut her eyes. But then, of course, the point comes when she does.
That's right.
And that point, too, when she gets to the very top, when she gets to the sky and looks up the kind of chimney that is the final staircase and goes, oh, you know what? I'll just go in the basket. I do not care about my dignity any longer.
Yeah.
And you can sense her age there, which is not to make her sound like an old crone, but she's a middle-aged woman and she's had a really long, tiring night. And where Tyrion is going now, I have my dignity. I'm not going to be hauled up in the basket with turnips. You know, I'm a Lannister. Lannisters do not hang out with turnips. Kat's kind of having to eat humble pie there just a little bit.
Absolutely, she is. And I think that to be, like, early on, she bristles at the idea that someone with the last name Stone would demonstrate more courage than someone who was born a Tully, right?
Mm.
And then you have to give her a little bit of credit. She's made it this far. And she's had some harrowing circumstances, but you're absolutely right. This humble pie that she's eating is a big deal because it wasn't that long ago she had made up her mind about how to judge Mia simply because of her status as a bastard. And you can kind of see here just a little hint of how hard Jon Snow would have had it being under that eye of Kat up in Winterfell. She doesn't even mention Jon's name when she thinks of him. She says she sees Mia, she hears that she's a bastard, and then she says, and that made her think of another bastard, Ned's bastard up at the wall. She won't even name him.
That's true.
And then, of course, she has opinions about Mia's prospects. But by the end, it's Mia who's like bringing Kat along with such care, such gentle patience, you know, words of encouragement, and she really sort of demonstrates how valuable she is. At that moment, Mia Stone is absolutely Kat's lifeline because she's paralyzed.
Yeah, that's a moment where she has to just put herself in the girl's hands. But she has had a little bit of a softening before, hasn't she, when she's reminded, having just thought about Ned's bastard, she also thinks that she's a little bit, Maya's a little bit like Sansa, that she has these slightly impractical dreams.
Sure.
So, but then that was at the beginning of the journey. And since then, she's almost fallen asleep and then been refreshed by the food at the first Wey Castle. And then, then she absolutely has to put herself in Maya's hands.
Was there anything in this chapter that struck you as that you thought, oh, this reminds me of that in my study?
I was interested because I'd quite forgotten that the Blackfish had decided to part company with his brother, Kat's father, and follow Lysa up to the Vale to serve her there. And I suppose what that did make me think about was the prospect for younger sons.
Right.
That Hoster Tully was always going to inherit River Run and was always, as we hear, a little bit too busy to take note of Kat and Lysa and Littlefinger as well when they were young. But the younger son, Brynden, had more time and was available to the kid there.
He became something of a father figure to the kids, even Peter and Kat and Lysa. They always felt that they could go to Brynden. And it says that he celebrated in their childhood triumphs and failure, you know, lamented with their failures. You know, he's something of a favorite uncle, but Hoster seems to be more of a distant father, which makes the favorite uncle role all the more pronounced. But like you say, he also has the predicament of being that second son.
Yeah, and what is he going to do with himself? And
Right.
you can see it's very typical, I think, of medieval noble brothers that they can't both do the same thing because there's going to be rivalry. They're going to fall out with each other,
Right.
and the younger one in particular needs to find something else to do. So Brynden is very wise to go off elsewhere and not to hang around being a loyal support to Hoster at River Run. He really does need to find his own way. But it's interesting that he chooses to go with Lysa, where he's always going to have to play second fiddle in some ways to John Arryn. But then I guess while John is down in King's Landing, the Blackfish, along with the Royces, who are the kind of wardens of the Vale, aren't they, has had quite a lot of power up there, I guess. And so it does make some sense.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to deal with that all too intimate relationship with an older brother, who's always going to view the Blackfish as this younger brother. And there's this wonderful scene, and it was really touching, actually. I got all the feels, Caroline, when he said, "You're far from home, little cat," and she says, "You are too, uncle." And he said, "My home is at my back," meaning my home is the Vale now, I think. And she responds and says, "Your home is in my heart." And I thought,
Yeah, that's beautiful.
it really was. It was. It really shows, how special this man is to her. It feels like Kat's going somewhere that she's never been before, but because she sees Brendan, it really is sort of like a homecoming for her.
You can feel her kind of breathing out with a
Yes.
sigh of relief when she sees him, because everybody has been so formal and so guarded up until now as she's coming to the Vale. And then at last there's a familiar figure who is a kind of forerunner, I guess, of what she might be hoping for from Lysa, even though she fears that Lysa may have changed a bit. She has no idea how much Lysa actually has changed. And yes, there's a real sense, because we haven't seen Kat with any of her family, her birth family, before. And we get a sense of what it must have been like to be loved like that as a child, and that sense of security that it must have given her.
You mentioned at the start how this chapter is something of a feat of Martin's world building, and that little moment made me think, oh yeah, this is such a dark world. Not just like these conniving figures who want to kill each other, but also the complicated relationship between family members. Everything in this story has led me to be wary of a relationship or what the real motive is. There's a lot of relational tension that Martin's created, so that when I encountered that little line, "Your home is in my heart," it's like this little taste of fresh water.
Yes.
Oh, I needed that kind of relief. I really needed that in this chapter, because you just want, more than anything, you want one of these characters to just express just a word of affection that's really authentic.
I think that's absolutely right, because Kat has been holding in so much for so long, hasn't she, in her journey ever since she set out. It's always been on the kind of knife edge.
Even when she's happily married up in Winterfell, it's not like this is her home. She never feels at home there. She's always going to be an alien in the Godswood.
Yeah.
Ned's always going to be he's always going to be a Stark. He's never going to be someone that's not sort of the typical Stark male. And
And it's
so,
interesting, isn't it, when when Brynden's trying to prepare her for the changes in Lysa and saying, she hasn't had it easy, Kat, down there in King's Landing. She had an arranged marriage, and then Kat breaks in and said, "Well, so did I." And it's a very
exactly.
sisterly thing to do, I think. So, well, she hasn't had it so tough. I've had it a bit tough as well. And then he says, "Yes, but she had the children and she lost them, and you're." And he kind of glides over the question of what we think we've seen, which is that Kat and Ned have really come to love and trust each other. and slides directly into, well, you've got lots of children, and she doesn't have any children except for little Robert, and he's a bit, and then he kind of tails off slightly.
Tell me this.
He's a sickly child.
Yeah. I have a question for you about this. Okay, so they're having that conversation. It's a Brendan cat. They're sort of walking through the valley. And Brendan says, I think she means to rule through her son. And Kat says, well, a woman can rule just as well as a man. And Brendan kind of gives her a side look and says, well, it would take the right woman.
Yeah.
All right. I wonder, is that sort of Martin bringing in a little bit of a modern sentiment, or do we see examples of that mentality in the medieval aristocracy?
Well, I think we certainly see examples of queens who are very invested in their sons when their husband dies, and who really relish the chance to rule in their minority. Mm-hmm. And to usually with a council of the son's uncles, maybe, to help out. But they really do like to be able to wield that kind of power. And I think that's something which is quite familiar. But the idea that a woman can rule if she's the right kind of woman, I think that's a bit of foreshadowing, isn't it? Is Cersei the right kind of woman? Because she's obviously going to be doing the same kind of thing, eventually ruling, kind of trying to rule through Joffrey, not very successfully, and then ruling through Tommen with Margaery, you know, coming up on the inside to displace her. And so Brendan may be thinking about that, but also kind of opening larger questions, which are going to haunt the entire narrative of, can a woman like Daenerys rule? Which at the moment, I don't think we would be at all optimistic about her chances, given where she is in the middle of the Dothraki Sea still. still sure. With a lot of learning ahead of her. So I think he's right there. I was also struck when Brendan was talking about the way that Lysa is kind of stringing along the suitors. And this reminded me a little bit of the figure of Penelope in the Odyssey, that she has these suitors queuing up to marry her. Not because, I'm sure Penelope is a lovely woman, but actually what they want is to get their hands on Ithaca and to try and cut Telemachus out of his birthright. Huh. And you can just imagine, we know that Nestor Royce, the warden of the Vale, has proposed and been turned down. And you can certainly imagine, like flies to a honeypot, suitors thinking, oh, well, here's my chance. And maybe that's also foreshadowing what's in Baelish's longer-term plan as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got a little reminiscence of late 1200s Italy, Spain, and France with the troubadours who would it was almost like sport, you know. It was like, here we are entertaining these, you know, ladies at court, and in this particular social set the woman does have the power to decide which man gets to, you know, gets to sing another song or gets to take her hand. There is something there that Lysa's sort of manipulating, I suppose.
I suppose so, though we've only got Brendan's word for it at this point, haven't we? And you kind of might well, I think at this stage, you might well imagine this is the kind of capricious lady who's playing the various suitors along and just waiting for the right man to come along. And then she'll give her heart and give the veil indeed to whoever captures her fancy. But I think by the time you meet her, you realize that this is just kind of strategic on her part.
Right.
And that actually the suitors, I think once they lay eyes on Lysa, they think, oh my goodness me, I mean, she's as mad as a bag of snakes. I do not want to get mixed up with this woman particularly, but for political reasons, I'll play that kind of courtly love game of saying that I'm in her service and I will do her will. And I think you're right. There is something of that kind of troubadour sentiment there, that the lady is all powerful, and where she wishes to grant her heart, then we will all be satisfied with that. But even in the 12th, 13th century, that was kind of opposed.
Yeah,
the real power was always residing with the men, and the woman nominally has some power until such time as she gets married, and then her servant becomes her lord, and that's when the tables are turned.
Right. I think Brendan has the right of it when he says, I think she likes the sport of it, but I don't think he quite knows why. I think it's, in reality, she's already chosen Littlefinger. And so she's going to play the long game and make it look like, you know, she's considering these men. Whereas Brendan thinks, well, she just likes, you know, the feeling of being wanted. And I don't think he quite sees what her end game is supposed to be.
I'm sure he doesn't. And I think, although he knows all of the characters there from their childhood, nobody quite realizes what sort of person Littlefinger has turned into. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't think the Blackfish is married himself, is he?
It doesn't sound like it. There's no mention of a wife or children or anything like that.
No. So I think he may very well be thinking, you know, sooner or later, all women want to get married. And so, you know, she's just playing the field for the moment. And I think he doesn't see necessarily the advantages of stringing it out, as you say, till as far as Lysa is concerned, Littlefinger turns up, as he's going to, you know, quite a long way down the road here.
What's the likelihood that, I'm just thinking about young Robert here, what's the likelihood that someone like that wouldn't be sort of nursed by a wet nurse? They really make a big deal of that in the show. But of course, it's here in this chapter as well. Lysa is, I suppose, infantilizing the boy instead of sort of making him a man. And this, of course, is a problematic for the Blackfish and problematic for Cat and whatnot. And I thought, yeah, but I mean, breastfeeding was just, it was just a given. And then I thought, well, maybe it's a little odd because she would have had a wet nurse.
Yeah, because the idea that you can't conceive again until you stop breastfeeding is something that is quite strong, I think. But I guess this lies sort of in her gynecological history, if you like, that she's had these children who died, she's had the miscarriages, and she wants to do everything that's within her power to make this one thrive.
Yeah.
And Brendan is kind of saying, well, she's invested everything in Robert. And he doesn't look like a great investment with the shaking sickness and everything else. Maybe there's also that hint that there's no particular passion in the marriage with John Arryn, and that having the one child who's still breastfeeding maybe keeps him out of her bed for some time. I don't know, that may be reading a bit too much in it. But there's that remark that she's so proud of, isn't she? Which, of course, turns out to mean something else entirely. The seed is strong.
That's
and
right.
And she has taken John Arryn's dying words, the seed is strong, to be a kind of encouragement to her that if she only nurtures Robert then and gives him all of the nutrients that she can make out of her own lineage and breastfeed to him, then he'll come through all right. And in fact, as we know, or as we will find out, John is talking about something else entirely.
Yeah, it's a great little trick that Martin is using here, because he puts the words of John Arryn on her lips, and we would imagine that she's quoting them pretty faithfully. She says that he keeps repeating his name, Robert, and says the seed is strong. And of course, we know in retrospect that John Arryn is saying something about King Robert.
Mm.
But because of Lysa's preoccupation with her own son, she's going to interpret those words in one way. And so, in other words, we might be getting sort of a direct quotation, but it's couched in a misdirection.
It's a nice piece of misdirection, yes. Isn't it? Yeah, because we soon come to think of the child as Robin, little sweet Robin, and not Robert after all. So we forget that kind of confusing element. But at this point, he's still Robert.
Right.
But we kind of, I think, are encouraged to overlook that.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I was thinking of is that because Lysa's had so many miscarriages and stillborn children, this sort of goes back to this really ancient problem for women of nobility, that their worth to the realm and really the pressure that's put on them by the realm is their value is tied to the ability to produce an heir.
Absolutely. And you can see when Brynden looks across from Lysa with this one sickly boy that she's managed to produce, and then all of the children, both boys and girls, mm-hmm. that Kat can claim as her own, not to mention Jon Snow, mm-hmm. Which of course Kat would not. That there's a real contrast there between the fortunes of the two sisters. And of course, yes. When we meet Selyse later on, she too suffers from the same kind of fertility problems, that she only has the one child. And that was a child who's a daughter and was almost taken from them by Grayscale.
Right. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in general, when there was a fertility problem, the blame always was with the woman, right?
Yes, that was the kind of rule of thumb.
So just get a new woman.
Yeah.
And I think that's also the problem with, I mean, you can kind of see that Lysa's extreme caution and her wanting to protect her son is somewhat, I want to use the word well-earned, just because so much of her own identity is tied up in the well-being of this child. And she knows how precarious the life of a child can be in a way that Kat hasn't really had to deal with.
I think that's absolutely right. Because Lysa, presumably, if she imagines little Robin dying, she can see the veil slipping out of her hands. I don't know who would be set to inherit. But it's someone who certainly owes her nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so she really needs to cling on to the boys as constituting her own foothold in the Vale and all the authority that she wields there. And she certainly does seem to have everybody dancing to her tune. So you can absolutely understand that kind of perhaps we're trying not to call her paranoid, because after all, the threat is real, isn't it?
Yeah, it's real. It's not in her mind.
That he's susceptible to any kind of disease that comes along. Uh-huh. But we have a sense already, though we don't know the full story, of what the Lannisters are capable of.
Uh-huh.
And even if we don't necessarily think like Kat does, that Tyrion is a murdering monster. And I think that's becoming clearer and clearer in this chapter as well, that Tyrion's protestations of innocence are completely credible.
Right.
And the way as well that Tyrion is kind of winning people round,
mm-hmm.
and building those alliances, and he's hanging out with Marillion, and that crucial relationship, mm-hmm. with Bronn is building there. And Brynden says, well, you know, When Kat says, well, I have brought a Lannister to my sister, but I brought him in chains. And Brynden says, well, he seems to be riding along with an axe in his hand, yeah. and a dirk at his side. And I don't see any chains there.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kat has to say rather hurriedly, well, no, but he's still absolutely in my control.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see Tyrion's charm at work there.
Yeah.
In a way that I think already is building our sense that he's somebody who is going to be one of the more sympathetic characters in the narrative.
Yeah, and there's that crucial moment where, you know, she's gonna go further beyond the first, you know, wayside castle, and Marillion says, you know, my lady, please let me come with you. I started at the beginning. I really should see this through to the end. And Kat feels like, I don't really owe this guy anything, but he's made it this far, and I think I should probably grant this request to come. And so she says yes to Marillion. And that actually is a really crucial moment, because as soon as that door's open, Bronn steps through it as well.
So good. Oh, yeah, I'm coming too.
Yes. If she would have said no to Marillion, she could have easily said no to Bronn, and she absolutely doesn't want Bronn and Tyrion to keep becoming friends.
Yeah, but it's going to turn out to be absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
And I think Marillion is such an interesting character at this point. Well, kind of generally, because it always strikes me that what the world of A Song of Ice and Fire is really interested in terms of the stories within that world, is usually history. It's the records that the maesters keep of what happened in the past, or it's kind of stories that old Nan tells, the sort of legend. But nevertheless, she tells things that she says happened, stories like the Ratcliffe and so on. But Marillion is a poet and an artist who's working now, and he's shaping story as we go along. And you can see that for him, inspiration for his songs is absolutely crucial, even if Tyrion kind of makes fun of him for trying to rhyme. And I think it's that sense that you have to let the storyteller come along too and be a witness to the narratives that he's going to shape later, even if the things don't turn out so well for Marillion.
Marillion's going to become a tragic character later on.
Yeah. But at the moment, he's slightly annoying, but he's likable. And he has a beautifully musical name. And you think, he's kind of lightening the picture a bit, because otherwise you've got Bronn being sardonic. You've got Tyrion trying to keep his spirits up and with the odd wisecrack. And then you've got a whole lot of men-at-arms who are not really easily distinguishable from one another. Mm-hmm. So you need to have a figure like Marillion. Bronn is really emerging at this point, isn't he, from just, some guy.
Yeah.
Into exactly the figure who's going to save Tyrion's bacon in his situation in the Eyrie, because the way the chapter ends is so, it always sends a shiver down my spine, the idea that nobody knows, Kat doesn't know, Ned has not mentioned, Ned's told Kat a fair amount about the Eyrie and how it has the seven towers pointing to the sky and so on, but he hasn't mentioned the sky cells and he hasn't mentioned the moon door.
That's right.
And we don't know about those horrors.
And Sweet Robin absolutely does.
We want to make that little man fly. Uh-huh. And there's Lisa going, Sam, maybe we will. Maybe we just will do that.
So some notable introductions in this chapter. We meet Sir Donal. We meet Brendan Tully. We see the Vale of Arryn and the Giant's Lance for the first time. We meet Sir Vardis Egan, Maester Coleman, Lord Nestor Royce, Mia Stone, and of course Sweet Robin, who's just called Robert. So a lot of introductions in this chapter. And I suppose because we're introduced to the Blackfish, that's an opportunity to give us a little bit of backstory with Hoster Tully and Kat's childhood.
Yeah, that's really important, I think. And Nestor Royce is that name. Nestor, of course, is a kind of another gesture towards the Odyssey as well.
But, tell me why. I missed that. Tell me why.
Oh, yeah. Nestor is a figure of wisdom. He's older and wiser than Odysseus.
Oh, that's right.
And so if we weren't thinking about Penelope with this kind of playing off the suitors against each other, I think the mention of Nesta's name is enough to kind of flag that up a bit.
Yeah, I missed the flag. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. A couple key differences between the show and the book. Well, all of this Blackfish stuff is deleted.
That's right. I didn't remember him showing up at this point in the show. And I think also the show ages up all of the children pretty well, doesn't it? For kind of practical mm-hmm. reasons as much as anything. But yeah. Robin is certainly not 6 in the show, is he?
No.
He's more like, I guess, about 10.
He's more like 10, and that brings out the problem of his clinginess, his sort of, I don't know, we say mama's boy.
Yeah, and the breastfeeding becomes really weird.
Yes, of course.
When he's that old.
That's right. And the more Elisa clings to the boy, the more people want to separate the two.
That's for sure. Because there's no man with any authority, no kind of role model in the castle that can help Robin become a Lord of the Vale, which is what his destiny is.
So that's the difference between the show and the book. In this chapter, it's very secretive. Kat and Lysa have that first conversation in Lysa's bedchambers, where in the show, she's at court. And
it's quite public, isn't it?
It's all very public. Mm. That's right.
Mm.
Yeah. So that was a key difference. And I do get the sense in this chapter just what a treacherous hike that is up to the Eyrie that you couldn't quite do in the show.
Yeah. Because what the show really emphasizes in a way is not so much the way up, but the quick way down.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I cover Season 4, Episode 5, The First of His Name. This is the Tommen coronation episode. Peter takes Sansa to the Vale. Dany decides that she's going to stick around in Meereen a little bit longer. And Jon's group of Avengers attacks Craster's Keep. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, Thirsty Boy's back.
Oh man, that boy's thirsty. That just doesn't outgrow it. Come on. He's get not, some solid foods, bro.
He's not the brightest kid you've ever met.
Man, this guy. This guy. It's like, it's interesting. You just a little bit of him goes a long way.
See, every now and again you think, yeah, why not kings and queens? And then you look at that guy and think, because of that. Because what if that's the only option for the Lord of the Eyrie? Yeah, so here's Sansa. She thinks that she's in a better situation?
Nope. Well, she's in a different situation.
Crazy Aunt Lysa.
Wow, she's crazy.
And Crazy Aunt Lysa wants to marry her to her simpleton son.
Mm-hmm.
Which... maybe better than, I mean, yes, definitely, definitely better, definitely better than Joffrey.
Well, sure. We assume. See, the thing is we don't know what this guy. He wants to throw the little man through the window, kind of thing. He's got a whole thing. This guy.
This is the kind of guy that says, "Hey, I love this gift. Thank you very much. Let me throw it out the moon door." It could be like, "I now pronounce you man and wife. I love you very much. I would like to see you fly."
Well, that's the problem, right? So Joffrey, it's like, you at least, we got a glimpse with Margaery that's like, okay, once you kind of figure out his kinks, you just sort of distract him with his kinks. Mm. This kid's dumber than dog shit. I mean, he is. he's a problem. And he's going to be a problem until he goes through the moon door.
Okay, so... do you remember how at the end of every Scooby-Doo episode, the villain would confess?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of got a little Scooby-Doo ending vibe from Lysa. And she, yeah. You know, she's trying to jump Baelish's bones. And she's like,
so she just
hey, remember all the bad things we did together? Let me detail them. Let me give you a bullet point list of everything we did together that was horrible.
Yeah, she's like a Bond villain who is just absolutely convinced that James will not escape.
So this goes back to the very first episode of Game of Thrones, because Ned goes south because Jon Arryn has been killed.
Right. Oh, okay.
And then Ned is trying to, like, figure out, like, what really happened to Jon Arryn, and what was the book Jon Arryn was reading, and why did Jon Arryn go visit Gendry, and all that business. That was a huge plot in the first season. And this is just a really unsatisfying conclusion to that plot.
Yeah, it just sort of, like, all right, we can move on from the, if anybody still remembered that.
Well, I remembered it, and that was a big deal, and I kind of felt like this, you're going to give me a Scooby-Doo ending on that plot? That was a really fascinating, yeah, I wasn't thrilled. Dany decides to stay and rule. She has a little lapse of confidence, you know, she was like, she was thinking about shaving the mustache off, but now... She's thinking, no, I think I'm gonna stay and just hang out. And I'm not. In other words, so here we have Tommen, who's clearly gullible, right?
Yeah.
And he's gonna be the king, and then Robin Arryn is clearly simple-minded. He's gonna be the Lord of the Eyrie. And then we have Dany, who's like, you know what? I don't think I want to be a child queen in Westeros. I think I'm going to grow up here, learn how to rule here, and then I'm going to go to Westeros when I'm ready. And so she messes up. She's like messing up a city she's already messed up.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting that she doesn't want to make the mistake of shooting her wad too early.
Right. And there's clearly some wisdom in that. We talked about that in the last episode, mm-hmm. too, about this, like, okay, you're leaving these vacuums. It's not really helping. I mean, it's helping you be a conqueror, so to speak. And that's good for your legend, but it doesn't necessarily set you up for long-term rule. Now she's working on empire building.
Arya and the Hound.
Arya and the Hound.
You still liking those two?
Yes. I mean, I think by having the Hound complicated again was good. I think it's a good reminder. And if we talked to before about how, like, oh, Arya's becoming like the Hound, and I think we were thinking, oh, well, maybe the Hound's becoming a bit like Arya. So we wipe that away. So then it becomes, so rather than it being like, oh, they'll help each other out as they adopt each other's personas, so to speak, by having the Hound still be the Hound, it creates a better sense of peril for Arya's journey if she doesn't.
And Arya, I think Arya at one point was thinking, this guy may be the best friend I've ever had.
Right.
Because he's great at killing, and I want to kill a bunch of people, and this is going to be wonderful for us. And then,
if he can develop some sort of a conscience, then now I can also be, then I don't have to feel bad about my loss of conscience because this isn't such a bad path.
Right. And then after what he does to that, you know, that father and daughter in the cottage, I think she remembers like, oh, there was a reason why this guy was on my list.
Right.
And then he finds her water dancing and he starts ridiculing her. And does she think that she's really going to kill him?
I know. I mean, I don't know what she...
Because she presses that... She presses a needle right against his armor and like it's almost a little surprised that it didn't go through.
Right. I couldn't tell what with the big... If she was more surprised that it didn't go through or more surprised that she just kind of went for it.
Yeah. I mean, he's on her list. No doubt about that.
I mean, he knows that he's on the list.
And it's almost like he thinks... It's almost like he doesn't view her as a threat. Like, she's not going to slit my throat in my sleep. She couldn't kill me with a rock. But then he gives her back needle. As if to say, I don't know. I mean, if someone tried to stab me with a knife and I was able to thwart them, I don't think I'd give them back the knife.
Yeah, I guess it, yeah.
But maybe that shows how. So there's a. So I've learned about this. So there's a certain. There's two different kinds of suicidal ideation. And one is active suicidality, which be like you're fantasizing about it, you're writing a note, you know, you're playing it through in your head. And then there's passive suicidality, where you just don't care. And so you're kind of playing fast and loose with your life. And you're like, if I don't die, this will be fun. But if I do die, I've had a good run and I kind of don't really enjoy living that much. So if the thrill at the end of this journey ends up in my death, I kind of don't care.
Yeah.
You see this a lot with addicts where they're like, yeah, if this is my last OD, then my life wasn't worth much anyway. And I kind of get the sense from the Hound that he's not afraid to die. And there's a tiny bit of him that's like,
set me free.
Yeah, a little bit. Not actively, but passively.
Right. Yeah. 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 Like if this is my fate, then he understands death enough, and he understands the idea that he's not above it.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that he brings it. There's no reason, like, it's almost like to some degree, maybe it's a mutual respect for death. It's like, look, I'll dish it out, but that doesn't make me immune from it. And that's part of what makes the idea of killing maybe even more attractive, is that it could happen to him at any time. So he's simultaneously defending against it while he's handing it out.
Shout out to mutual friend Jason Swain, who taught me about suicidal ideation.
Yeah, we should probably call him.
See how he's doing.
Do a quick little buddy check, because if I recall, he just brought that up in conversation.
Hey, considered?
Have you ever considered the benefit of just being wiped off the planet? Anyway, got to go.
What was that? Pass me a beer, Jason. I loved the dialogue between Cersei and Oberyn. Where I think that those two have some kind of mutual respect. This was a strong Cersei episode. I really was feeling for Cersei, like separated from her daughter, and you just get the sense that she does really love her children, right?
Right.
And I thought,
well, and isn't that? And if again, not to just sort of belabor the sociopath point, but like we've learned, I think, you know, if not from psychology classes, from other TV shows that would focus on that kind of behavior, that like children and animals tend to be something that will they, like, where any sense of affection,
right,
or empathy would go that direction, right? And then beyond that, like, determining that which they see is helpless and gives them sort of a purpose or a power over, right? I
mean, and the fact that her children are an extension of her own identity, because either by way of what society has done to her or by way of her own narcissism or whatever, those are the people in her world that she projects her self-love onto, I suppose.
Right.
I mean, that's one way to look at it. I do think that she does have a strong motherly affection. And I think it's interesting when she sort of sidles up to Marjorie.
Yeah.
And you think that she's going to totally, you know, threaten her life or do whatever. She kind of gets vulnerable about Tommen's innocence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my thought there was, even when Cersei's being her most vulnerable, she's still really dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. Because you get the sense of that there's more to it than this, right? This isn't.
Yeah, I get the sense that, like, all right, she's being vulnerable. Now, if I'm vulnerable, that doesn't mean that she won't entrap me with that information later.
Yeah. 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 She's amongst all the ones that you just don't trust. You don't take anything at face value.
Yeah, even when she's. Yeah, right. All right, so the big deal in this episode is what happens at Craster's Keep. So Bran is a hostage, and Mira and Jojen are hostages, and Hodor is Hodoring, and...
Yeah, he certainly is.
Clubfoot Carl is... boy, that fight scene with the knives, that was something.
Yeah, and Carl's end. Oh, baby.
I think they did a great job in a very short amount of time of establishing that Carl is formidable.
Right.
And menacing. And so you kind of got the sense that Jon's actually in trouble here. And really they didn't introduce him with many episodes. So I liked what they did with him, and I thought that the choreography of that fight scene was pretty great.
For a character you didn't really see a bunch of, it was very effectively done, into the point where I never felt like he was not a real big threat.
And I think part of it was sort of Rast, because Rast himself was a bully.
Right.
So if you can bring in a guy that bullies the bully or whatever.
And really just bullied him down. Like Rast seemed like Sam in that situation.
And then Rast like kicks Hodor or whatever and said, if I had your body, I would rule the world or something like that.
Right.
And you get you got the sense there that you don't get to choose the body that you're born into, but if you're Bran Stark,
you can choose which one you go into. I guess.
Yeah, you got options. You got options. So we saw Bran go into Hodor, which I guess at that point he's Brodor.
I like it.
And then Brodor does my least favorite fight choreography, where he picks up Locke by one hand by the throat and holds him up in the air. I feel like I see that in every action flick. Every action flick. And it's almost like these choreographers have never seen a fight before. I mean...
Yeah, it doesn't... The dramatic effect it's going for rarely moves anymore.
It's like, oh, that guy's really strong. Yeah, but what? Why isn't he using his other hand? If he really wants to kill this guy, is he...
Well, and it's a time... It's a time waster.
It's a,
and you hold somebody up, and then all they have to do is, if they've got a knife or whatever, they can cut you right under the arm, and that's
that did subvert the trope a little bit, because normally what happens is what you're saying, you know, someone will hold you up against the wall by one hand, and then someone will come and, you know, slit your throat or whatever.
Right.
In this case, Brodor just snaps his neck.
Yeah, he just, it's happening. I mean, that was a big deal. And then you do, and for the first time, I got a sense of Hodor mattered to me a little bit.
Say more about that.
Because all of a sudden you're like, I don't think Hodor wanted to do that.
Yeah, okay. And that's good.
And I think that's an important moment, because it's like, I mean, Hodor gets exploited, man. And
and that actually is drawn out a lot in the books. Like, Martin describes that Hodor is like cowering in fear in a little corner in the back of his mind.
And, you know, Bran's trying to say, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. But basically, he gets mind violated.
Yeah. And no matter, yeah, sure, Bran is the one pulling the strings, but Hodor now is saddled with the memory and whatever knowledge he has to know that he just snapped somebody's neck. And that doesn't seem like that's Hodor's jam.
No, Hodor likes the Hodor.
Well, Hodor, Hodor, Hodor. That's all we know for sure.
All right.
Far be it from us to fill in those blanks, but
okay, help me with something. All right, so Rast is running away. He's the only one that escapes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where does he go? He runs over to where the wolf is being kept, because why?
I don't know.
Like, let me run right over here to this wolf that I just antagonized. Because, well, no reason. I guess I want to give the wolf a chance to get revenge. Like, that didn't work for me.
Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of audience service in a lot of these.
Yeah.
A lot of these scenes.
Yeah, you could have had him run through the woods or whatever. That could have worked. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm glad Rast got eaten by a wolf, but, just think about these things ahead of time. That's what I'm asking.
So this is now you're showing a lot more critique over production choices than you have been prior. Is this in part just the way things are breaking down, or is this somewhat coinciding with the now we're starting to see divergence from the books?
That's a good question.
Therefore, you feel like maybe they're falling more into television/movie tropes as opposed to following the literature.
That's good. This is all very complicated, because I will say this, that I think that if you ask the, you know, garden variety Game of Thrones fan, they would say season 4 is their favorite.
I was doing so because I was trying to avoid any kind of spoilers, but I've been trying to like do a little bit of that kind of research, mm-hmm. right? Like, what is the perception of these seasons? And I think that's because, you know, we talk so much about 7 and 8 and the problems and the this and the that, but then when you mentioned about all the different choices that are going to be made that go away from the book, I was very curious to see what is like. So you'll find these like articles like the Game of Thrones episode or seasons ranked from mm-hmm. you know best to
worst. 4 is pretty high on anyone's list.
If four shows up very high, so that sort of colored my
perception. Say this, okay, let me sort of run down the problems for me. I like this episode. I like it a lot. I think it has some of the best dialogue of the entire series, and I didn't like the previous episode or episode 3,
two episodes prior.
Yeah, at all. I didn't like that at all.
No, you did not.
So I think that this season ranks pretty high for me on the list. I don't normally just hate anything that diverges from the books. I think in a lot of ways, when they've made choices that diverge from the books, I've liked them. I've liked what they've done. I do like the season. I do like this episode. Let's do a quick power ranking.
Okay.
Who's going to sit the Iron Throne, Steve?
Okay, so just...
I mean, it ain't going to be Joffrey anymore.
No, it's not going to be Joffrey. I think we can wipe off Greyjoy, just because I feel like his leech has got to come into effect.
If it was going to be Greyjoy, don't you think that they would have put a little bit more in their story?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, it's like there was like, oh yeah, remember Greyjoy? And everyone's like, no, actually, I don't. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be Theon.
It's not going to be Hot Pie.
It's not good. Ah, don't sleep on Hot Pie.
Hot Pie's gone.
Well, geez. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think I'm going to shift. I'm going to shift to Danny.
Danny, yeah, Danny on the Iron Throne.
I mean, she's got dragons, she's got an army, and she hit the pause button.
And she's as confident as a Hitler wearing mustache wearing Michael Jordan.
Yeah, and I think the fact that she is sort of like, all right, let's do a trial run and see how that works out. I think that there's something to be said for that. That shows the wisdom that Tywin was sort of hinting at, right?
Well, okay, all right. So this is interesting because just in these last couple episodes, we've seen hints that Dany may not be as altruistic as we wish she was.
Sure.
So does that mean that in order for us to feel good about her on the Iron Throne at the end, it seems like her character will have to have some kind of come to Jesus moment where she realizes, I'm not going to be like my father. I'm not going to be mad for vengeance. That kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because that is what we say we want.
Yeah.
And that's what we say would be satisfying. But I think what we've seen is we saw it with Ned, we saw it with Rob, is that the better you are, the better intended you are, does not necessarily mean a whole lot in terms of victory and in terms of being the best suited, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it would be great if, for all we know, Tommen may be the best king option out there just because he's so darn sweet and stupid. But that's not, I don't find that to be realistic. So I see.
Right. If Tommen's on the throne, it means Tywin and Margaery are in charge, right?
Right. And so if Dany, you know, sure, she's had her issues as of late, and we've seen some concerns about her ability to be altruistic or whatever. But I think she's got time. If she takes the time to lead, she might find some balance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing about Dany that we haven't discussed. Let's say she does top the power ranking. She's a woman, and mm-hmm. if she decides to marry for an alliance,
right?
So
I don't think she follows that type of pattern.
Yeah, so that's a little tricky. I mean, it's tricky because Westeros has seen queens in the past. But normally the man gets to have all the power. So
yeah.
All right. Well, we'll keep track of the power rankings.
That's my two cents. We'll see what happens.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to keep with the theme of veiled politics. This is a short excerpt of a longer conversation that I had with Gregory Webster. Greg has some interesting insights into Sweet Robin's character I thought I'd include it here. Here is psychologist Greg Webster. I mean, one thing that we're lacking in these stories so far is intrigue that's north of the wall. You know, we have a menace north of the wall. But Craster's gone, and who else is actually, you know, bringing us, and, you know, Mance Rayder's gone. Who's actually going to bring us intrigue north of the wall? Right. What if we have competing Greenseers?
I think there's definitely that potential, right? So you get these, you know, people with somewhat psychic forces battling it out, and, you know, Preston Jacobs is an advocate of Sweet Robin having those types of powers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. One of the reasons why it's believed that he's being administered Sweet Sleep all the time is it Sweet Sleep or Milk of the Poppy? I forget which, but he's been being given, I think it's Sweet Sleep, at levels that would pretty much knock out an adult. Just to help him sleep, is to actually deaden his psychic powers. And in fact, there are other George Martin novels where, you know, there are characters either take chemicals to, you know, heighten their psychic awareness. In fact, we get that even in this series, but they also get chemicals to deaden them.
Right.
And there's this one point where, Sweet Robin is more or less kind of described as a sickly kid most of the time. Mm-hmm. And he's usually described as being pretty physically weak. And he's also, you know, he's a little boy. He's I forget how old he is. Like, he's like 5 or 6, you know, and he's still not weaned. Mm-hmm. But he refuses to eat his porridge. And he's able to, like, fling this bowl of porridge like across the room to the extent that it hits the maester in his, I think, stomach or rib cage and knocks him, I think, on the floor and knocks the wind out of him or something like that. So if you watch any of Preston Jacobs' things, he draws on a lot of other books and short stories mostly short stories in George Martin's kind of expanded Thousand Worlds universe, where he talks about teak, which is short for telekinesis, which is, of course, the power to kind of, you know, usually move objects or influence the movement of objects in the physical world. And I know this is total, like, tinfoil theorizing here, but there's, you know, some possibility that a lot of the so-called magic that's going on in the Stark children isn't so much from the Starks themselves, but actually from the Tullys.
Oh,
going back along their, you know, female lines to... what's her name, who used to bathe in blood, I'm trying to remember who the Tullys are, the Wents, right? So the Tullys, Hoster Tully, I think, married a Went, one of those bat families. I forget which one, but the families that used to live at Harrenhal.
Yeah.
Who practiced all sorts of dark arts. And one of them was this woman who would bathe in blood, supposedly, and allegedly her bats would fly around at night snatching up children to sacrifice them to keep her young and so on.
I'm going to look this up because I want to know her name.
But she's like a great grandmother or great.
Is it Danielle Lofton?
Yes, Lofton, right. So it was I think Harrenhal was passed from the Lofstons to the Wents, and then someone else, but the Tullys, or at least the Tully daughters, I think through their female ancestry go back to her. And so, you know, there could be some sort of, you know, weird thing going on with their line that maybe, you know, took some generations to show up. I don't know.
So it could be that Sweet Robin is manifesting some of these. And if that's the case, and there are sort of these magical midichlorians in in Catelyn's blood.
Right.
And we also know that there's midichlorians in the First Men blood, right?
Yeah, or some of them.
Anyway. Some of them, anyway. It could be that Bran is a beneficiary of both lines, right?
Right, right.
My thanks, as always, to Professor Webster. If you're interested in something that Greg wrote and published online, you can look up his name, Gregory Webster, and then put in personality perception : Game of Thrones. It's about how fans perceive their favorite characters and in some ways project their own personalities onto those characters. It's a bit technical, but it's available online, and I thought it was fascinating. And that's all for this week.